Well, it is a huge pleasure to meet Susan Norville. And Susan, we of course have a history that goes back, I think it's now more than 30 years, because we were at Lampeter together.
Yes, yes, indeed. I mean, that was, you know, wonderful, wonderful place. And I have, incredible memories of Lampeter, really.
It's really interesting because I know you did Victorian, was it Victorian Studies and English?
And English literature, yes.
And I always remember, it's really those sort of things, and you situate people in particular places. And I know that, was it Weston-super-Mare that you grew up?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I'm from Somerset, Weston-super-Mare.
Yeah.
Yes, born there in 73. And,
and we were discussing just before we started recording that I think there's 10 days between us.
Right, yeah. Right, yes.
But we'll leave the listeners to work out who's which one was born first.
Yes, no, it was a wonderful place growing up. And yeah, I guess I wanted to go somewhere that was pretty countrified when I went to university. So like you, I think Lampeter was my first choice.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And I think it was a wonderful time because we had grants in those days.
Correct. Mm.
So it was a case of you can go wherever you want and the money will follow. I mean, it's so different because obviously I work in the university sector now and that isn't available.
Of course.
But you chose to do Victorian Studies. And I think Lampeter was probably the only place you could do that.
Correct.
Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that was part of the reason that I chose Lampeter, so that I could indulge my love of Victorian literature, specifically Wilkie Collins, Dickens, the Brontes. Yeah, I absolutely, I just loved Victorian literature and that's what I wanted to study. Plus doing English as well, I could study sort of medieval as well as, the Victorian.
I just have this flashback. I remember it may have been after we graduated or we were waiting for those results, that sort of interim limbo or purgatory period where we're sort of like, what's going to happen with the rest of our lives? And we all went to a beach somewhere in West Wales. And I vaguely recall, what probably doesn't quite count as Victorian, but Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. I remember you were reading that.
Right.
And that, whether that was extracurricular or part of the curriculum.
I can't remember. That's
because that would have been
tricky.
Probably when the Scorsese adaptation
came
out.
So probably we were watching the film at that time. I remember the beach itself could have been Penryn or Munt.
Could be.
I remember both those beaches quite well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some one. You know, the coastline around that area is particularly amazing, isn't it? Really.
Yeah. Because I think we had. I often think that Lampeter, although it's a very countrified area, because we had the sea so close, and you grew up obviously near the sea, it kind of ticked all the right boxes. That was my sense.
Yes.
Obviously it was the course that perhaps particularly attracted you, but how did you feel about the place, Lampeter?
Oh, no, I mean, I loved it from day one, probably the same as you. But I think I was intrigued to go there because when I saw the prospectus, I distinctly remember seeing a picture of the old building, which was based on an Oxbridge college. And it is, I think it's the oldest university, isn't it, in Wales?
Yeah, indeed, in the whole UK outside of Oxford,
exactly.
Cambridge and St Andrews.
Yes. So that, for me, was also pretty enticing. The fact you could go study somewhere, in the depths of the countryside. Obviously being Wales was something I hadn't, somewhere I hadn't been before particularly. I'd been across the bay to Cardiff, but that was probably about as far as I'd been into Wales, I think, really.
And those connections, I'm always interested in the way that you go to a place. And I was joking with you earlier that you can take the student out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of the student. But here we are 30 years on. I mean, we're in touch probably, as with, so many other friends on the, society Facebook page and so on. But it's so funny that all these years on, those connections, the things that we have in common, those conversations that mattered 30 years ago kind of still persist. And was that special about Lampeter? If we'd gone somewhere else, maybe we would be having the same sort of, nostalgia about the place. But was there something about Lampeter that you think is special? Do you still sort of hold it very dearly in your hearts after all these years?
Yes, I think, I really do think there was something particularly special about Lampeter. The fact that when we were there, there were approximately 900 students and I think 900 people lived in the town. So there was an equal number, townsfolk, university students. We fed the university, we were instrumental in aiding the town in terms of using the restaurants, the pubs, etc. But also the townsfolk, we came to know quite a few of them. I had friends there, Welsh friends as well as English friends, and it became like a lovely society, I think, the whole place.
Yeah.
It really was.
And it's the sort of place as well that kind of changes in a different way to the rest of the world, because it's based on a very sort of old college, and that sort of is the hub of the place, and that hasn't changed. But it's also the sort of place that people make their home. So you've got all of the local people who obviously were there anyway, kind of thing, but also those students, and I was one of those for a while because I was there for 10 years, but who made it their home, their adopted home, or in some cases it became their permanent home and where their families moved.
Yes.
So it's a very special place considering its location.
It is. I think it's a very relaxing place, and I think you do have to perhaps be a specific type of person who does appreciate the countryside to live there. And I also think that you found out quite quickly if you weren't that kind of person when you moved to Lampeter. There were one or two, you might remember, who, left the first week or two, maybe the first month or so. But after that, I really think the majority of people I knew from Lampeter absolutely loved it and enjoyed their time there very much. And we really did fall back upon our peers, I think, because it was such a small community, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, and it was the sort of place where, I mean, we didn't have social media, we didn't have mobile phones in those days.
No.
And yet, for some reason, whereas now you'd have to message somebody and say, are you going out tonight or whatever? But in those days, you were guaranteed to see the same people like seven times a day.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I think my friend Mel, who I shared a room with in the first year, I distinctly remember her saying to people that, oh, Susan's gone walkabout, because I would go walking around campus just to chat to people, and make it my mission to have a few conversations that day. As you say, there were no mobile phones, so it was incredibly sociable.
Yeah.
I really think it was very, very much so.
Yeah, and what I found is that because it was an era where, if you wanted to speak to the rest of the world, you'd need to go to the phone box and queue up, because we'd all be queuing up at 6 in the evening, because in those days it was cheaper after 6, or we were sort of strange dynamics. But the people mattered so much that you'd have those physical interactions with people, in the sense that you'd be in the union, you'd be in lectures, but you always saw the same people. I mean, the ironic thing, and there will be people listening to this who I'm in touch with now, who I didn't know in those days, and have developed sort of good friendships with. But generally speaking, those friendships, it seems to me, have really persisted through time, because I was off. I wasn't on social media for a number of years, things going on in my life where that I was not in the right place for that. But suddenly around 2017, suddenly all the old suspects, all the usual suspects, were kind of there and gathered and ready to sort of pick up almost from where we left off all those decades earlier. And I found that really quite moving. And
yes.
It was like suddenly that deep connection with your past, with your heritage.
Yeah, I think it's very reassuring, isn't it, to know that those people are still out there and there for you. And we do have that connection with Lampeter, because obviously we have the the London dinner, and I know you yourself go to the reunions as well. Yes, it was an incredible 3 years for me, and if I could have stayed longer, I would have done, I think.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, I'm sure we'll come back to Lampeter for sure, but I'm just interested in a bit about sort of growing up, and obviously Somerset, and I know, because these days you live in Kent, not too far from where we are now.
Yes. That's right. Yes, I live in Tunbridge Wells, but I did grow up in Somerset. I went to school in Weston-super-Mare originally. I went to a very small school just near the seafront, which was in an elderly lady's house. So it was an incredibly small school called Wincroft. I then went somewhere called Uphill Primary for a year, and from there to St Dunstan's, still in primary, in Burnham-on-Sea, which sadly closed a year after I'd started there. I was incredibly upset about that, because it was a wonderful, wonderful school. And from there, I went to Bristol, to St Ursula's School, Convent School for Girls. So it was mixed in the junior school. So I was there for 1 year as a junior, and then to the secondary, which was all girls.
Yeah.
So, yes, I was sort of quite used to Bristol, because I also went there for my first job. I worked there for a year or so after.
And was that the hotel?
No, I did hotel work when obviously waitressing during my university years, plus some teaching English as a foreign language. I worked for the Bristol and West Building Society. That was my first job, ostensibly as a mortgage counsellor, although I got into rewriting some of their standard letters in the corporate communications department. So,
wow.
Yes, I always knew, I suppose, that I wanted to write from a very young age.
Yeah, we'll come to that. But as we were talking about summer jobs, am I right in thinking that you were working at a hotel on the set of The Remains of the Day.
Well, not quite. I was working as a waitress, not in a cocktail bar.
I was going to say, you took me back to 1981 there.
This is 1991, I imagine, or 92. I'm struggling to remember, actually.
Well, the film came out sort of 93, so it probably would have been that summer, 92
probably,
or so.
Probably 92 then, and I was working on the seafront at a hotel that doesn't exist anymore, but the Albert Hotel in Weston. And I came out from the breakfast shift, I think, walked along the seafront, and who was right in front of me? Anthony Hopkins. And there was somebody talking to him, and I literally would have walked straight into him. So I just said hello, and we had a little chat about the weather. And then I did happen to meet one of the cameramen who was working on The Remains of the Day, only because, again, I was walking past the set pretty much every day. And he chatted to me and said, oh, if you want to be an extra, we're looking for extras in Bath. And I was offered a job as an extra in Bath, but sadly I had to go back to Lampeter, so wasn't in The Remains of the Day. But what a wonderful chance to meet Anthony Hopkins. And actually, I did watch a couple of the scenes, which were filmed at the Winter Gardens in Weston-super-Mare, which is right along the seafront. And I think that's where he meets Emma Thompson to speak to her. And that's where they filmed that. So, yes, it was, and it was particularly... particularly appealing for me because I really, really did love the book. It is one of my favourite books. I think Linda might have mentioned that to you, that she loved the book too.
She did. And the author, of course, was a student here in Kent.
Oh, wow.
And also Anthony Hopkins, of course. You say you had to leave, you know, the opportunity to be on the set,
only to
go back to
Lampeter,
only to find Anthony Hopkins, of course, had this huge Lampeter connection because he was given sort of an honorary degree, in the summer of 92.
Yes, were you there? I did meet him again
I happened to be there in 92, and then a year or so later... he came and gave a talk, and I missed it in the Cliff Tucker Theatre. But I know I know friends who have... We didn't have selfies in those days, but a few people have their Anthony Hopkins photo in pride of place, apparently, in their house.
Yes, he signed my book, because obviously it was... I didn't say, oh, you've met me before, but it was amazing to meet him. I think he did his impression of, was it Hannibal Lecter from The Time? Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yes, and he was just very pleasant, I think, to meet, wasn't he, Anthony Hopkins? And not quite how he was in Hannibal Lecter.
No, certainly. Well, and I didn't actually go, I can't believe it, because considering my interests now, I should have gone to that. But I think either I had a lecture or I was busy doing an essay or something. And for some reason, I didn't take the opportunity to go. But I did meet him because I was there in the summer of 92. My sister was staying there in the summer. So it would have been after our first year in Lampeter, and she was doing a postgraduate degree. And we happened to sort of walk over to the arts hall with my parents. And Anthony Hopkins walked by because of Alan Samuel, who would have been one of your lecturers.
Really,
he was presenting him for the honorary degree. And I've seen the clip, actually, that he gave to the students. You know, Anthony Hopkins addressed the students not too long ago. So it's available somewhere online. But phenomenal memories. How did you find, you know, growing up in Somerset, in terms of all the sort of things that Lampeter kind of like didn't have, like it didn't have a cinema, although we had the arts hall, which kind of was a bit makeshift, but was there sort of any sort of like disconnect between what you were used to? Because I came from the city, but never really sort of made the most of it. I didn't, you know, go to the cinema in those days. But did you find that when you were living in Somerset, you made the transition to Lampeter? Was it an easy transition? Did you kind of feel it was home from home, or did you sort of have to press the reset button?
No, that's, I've never really thought about that, to be honest. I think because I guess I'm from the edge of town country anyway. My parents live on the edge of the Mendip Hills, the edge of Weston. So when I went there, yes, there wasn't a cinema per se, but I mean, we had an arts club, didn't we? We had a cinema club. We had everything you could possibly need, I think, as far as I was concerned. And the community itself was so great that whatever you needed was there. I really do think if you were somebody who was into the big city, then, and you wanted that, it wasn't for you. Yeah. But that wasn't what I wanted at that stage of my life, certainly.
Yeah. Because I think it's like the jolt that I needed, because I came from the city, but was probably at the age that I went to university, I think I was probably not quite ready, you know, to have, I didn't live a city life kind of thing. And yet, after spending many years in Lampeter, I was really ready, more than I realised at the time, because I know in Kent I obviously have easy access to London.
Yes.
But I think by the time I finally left, I was clearly ready to do so. Mm-hmm. But Lampeter was part of my formation. So going to a small place where things happened at a different pace to everywhere else, was kind of a great, you know, in a way it was a better introduction to the world because the world came to Lampeter. Because in such a small place, you'd be meeting people every day who were from every possible continent. You know, we'd have students from all around Europe, we'd have Australia, a lot of Canadian or American students, and in later years, Chinese students from the Middle East, those doing Islamic studies, for example. And so it felt this incredibly eclectic, cosmopolitan place. And it was also a Welsh market town. And it was that sort of juxtaposition that felt like you wouldn't get that sort of dynamic anywhere else, certainly not in one of the cities.
No, that's true. I do think it was, an incredibly unusual, unique place, wasn't it, to live? And that's essentially what we all fall back upon in terms of our memories of the place, because we have these, you know, wonderful memories that people can't take away, I guess.
Yeah. What about things like earliest memories? So that really take you back to Somerset. But were you a great reader?
Yes.
So was that something that was really like, did that play a big part in your, obviously not just in school, but outside of that? Was like reading the thing that you, was that your sort of like hobby?
Yes, I suppose reading, writing. I really enjoyed playing tennis. I loved singing. You know, those were all the things that I really enjoyed when I was growing up. I did play the piano as well. Yeah, I think that reading, specifically, I loved Anne of Green Gables. Yeah. I used to think, you know, that was me, that was my life, and I made up this name. I had all these middle names mainly because my parents didn't give me a middle name. So because I was Susan Norville, I made myself a much more interesting name, which was Susan Anne Emily Cordelia Ophelia Norville. And I don't tell many people that. So, yeah, I guess that's slightly embarrassing. But that's something I did when I was growing up. I gave myself all these additional names because I was quite annoyed that I didn't have a middle name when I was growing up.
So you rather overcompensated by giving yourself...
Yeah.
I think I counted a dozen there.
Yes, I think so, yes. Yeah.
And also, you've just reminded me, because I went to Scarborough a few years ago and I was doing an interview there. And I think, didn't you do post-Lampeter, was it a literature course?
No, I did a PGCE. So, yes, I qualified as a teacher, actually, in Scarborough. And I did my teaching practices in Scarborough, Whitby and in Middlesbrough as well.
Yeah, I went to those three very places in 2019.
You know, that was a wonderful, wonderful place to be. I mean, I really am drawn towards the sea. And Scarborough is absolutely incredible, beautiful place. Whitby was fascinating for me because of the connection with Dracula. Yeah. Scarborough with the Brontes, you've got Anne Bronte's grave is there. So
I think you gave me directions as to how to get there.
Probably, yes, probably. So, yeah, that was an interesting period of my life. Obviously, it was a year. It was very, very, very stressful course, actually. Yeah. And I think 2/3 of us passed. I think I'm correct in saying that. But it was very, very difficult, that course. I found the bureaucracy of becoming a teacher was a lot for me.
Because I get the sense that you didn't pursue that, because I didn't know that about you. So actually, you trained to be a teacher, but that wasn't something that you followed through?
Well, I suppose I always wanted to write. That's what I wanted to do, write, edit. And going into that, I could see myself teaching probably literature to older children, but this was actually a primary course, so I qualified primary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't have worked in the same way?
I don't think so for me, you know, long term, no.
Scarborough was, I know you were very effusive about the place, and I was drawn to it, and I'd like to go back, and if it hadn't been for lockdown, I probably would have done. Mm. And this was my sense, that you had the Gothic, you know, on the hills, where Anne Bronte's grave is, it's you know, magnificent, and it feels like you're in that sort of...
And you have the two bays, of course.
Yeah.
North Bay, South Bay, which is quite unusual.
And you're looking up there, and it feels that you're in touch with that whole sort of, like, Victorian sort of mindset. But then you've got the seafront itself, which is very... quite tacky, as a lot of sort of seaside towns are.
Most seaside resorts
and that's not a criticism of it.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is that it was the very sharp juxtaposition of the old and the new. You've got like the Ferris wheel, or the equivalent of the Millennium Wheel in Scarborough now.
That's right, Scarborough Fair along the seafront.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, it is a really, really beautiful place. It has some incredible masonry, I think, beautiful architecture. I lived in Grosvenor Crescent, and was very fortunate to rent a place which was number one Grosvenor Crescent, and it included the tower. So we had a view right across the bay, which was wonderful, with a friend of mine, Alison. I lived there, and another lady lived there as well with us. We shared that rented accommodation for the year, but we were very fortunate that we were so close to town and yet had these incredible views across Scarborough.
Yeah. And so you, obviously the Victorian sort of literature is something that has always appealed, but what made you do that as an undergraduate, as part of your degree? What made you want to specialise in Victorian literature?
I just think it was probably the beauty of the literature. Mm. I'd always enjoyed Sherlock Holmes. You know, I was completely obsessed with Jeremy Brett's Sherlock Holmes as a teenager growing up. I really, as I said to you before, I loved Dickens. I really thought the Brontes were wonderful. And I just imagined myself in that world more than the world of today. Yeah. That was just how I saw myself. I think my sister saw that I was like that too and used to joke about me, you know.
Was your sister very different in terms of her outlook?
Yeah, she's quite different. She's more modern, I suppose. Yeah. And I was quite old-fashioned, perhaps, in my outlook probably then.
Yeah. It's funny how that happens. And would you say in that sense that you haven't changed, or you've changed but you've changed on that same sort of trajectory? In other words, the interest that you had then still carry over now, because I've met students who sometimes like change degree programs and they almost like become a different person. Although suddenly one, somebody I know, who she used to dress in a certain way, very sort of, you know, she wear a head scarf when she was doing her religious studies degree. She went to sport science and suddenly wearing tracksuits and everything, and it was almost like I did not recognise the same person. And I find that really interesting. It's like someone trying to, you know, find the right course for yourself. But it sounds like you probably found the right course, but you're living out a life which kind of fits with what you perhaps expected and wanted to do back in your teenage years.
Yes, that's fair to say. I couldn't imagine myself doing sports science or anything like that, whereas my sister, perhaps she could. She's very sporty. I do actually enjoy sport, funnily enough. I do like badminton, tennis. I haven't been able to play them much this last year, but you know, I'm not the sportiest person. But yeah, for me it was always going to be Victorian literature. There's just a beauty about the language. I think it was close enough to the present that I could see almost a living connection. And one day recently I thought about this, because it crossed my mind that my father, who was born in 1938, when he was a young boy, somebody from Dickens' era could have been an old man. And that for me was quite staggering, just the thought of that, you know? Yeah. It really is, it blows you away.
Yeah, you're right, but somebody I interviewed in Swansea, who's now a retired school teacher, she said that she was at school in the 1950s and she was taught by teachers who were born in the 19th century. They probably would have been like 60 at the time.
Yes.
But you know, how extraordinary that sort of relationship that with the past. And that's why I find it odd, because, you know, when we were at Lambeth in the 90s, it felt, you know, we were the young generation, whatever it is.
That's right.
But what is so extraordinary is that I look back now and the students that I teach were born post-2000. And so my own children were a lot younger than that again. And somehow the 90s feels like a distant memory, increasingly so. Although the music of the time was often kind of quite a lot of like garage music, house music, it felt not really my thing. So there was something very kind of very different from the 90s, from stuff that came a decade or two before, Stone Roses and all sort of stuff. But what's interesting is that kind of now feels really dated, because people who were in their 20s then would now be in their 50s. People who were my age, you know, we're both, you know, the very late 40s, would now be pushing 80. And when you think of it in that way, there's a part of me that really has this urgent need to kind of want to reconnect with all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely the difference in music was noticeable in the 90s, because although you had the garage music, you also had a lot of incredibly memorable music. I mean, if you think about the two longest running number ones, weren't they? 1991, when I started university, and 1994, when I left. It was Everything I Do It For You, and Bryan Adams, and then Wet Love Is All Around when we left, or when I left in 94. And I just remember that because they are such, you know, pivotal moments in my life, I think, starting and leaving university. Yeah. But also The Scorpions, isn't it? Wind of Change. I remember listening to that when we were driving into Lampeter. Yeah. All these songs just evoke such clear connections with that time in my life, I think.
Were you telling me, it may not have been you, but were you telling me that you had a mixtape of music from that era?
Probably several tapes, I think. One, in fact, BBC Radio 2, they played Simon & Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water, the other day, and it took me back. A friend of mine, he'd created this mixtape for. In fact, no, he created the whole of, it was the whole of Simon and Garfunkel, and it was amazing. I didn't really know that much about their music.
It was always played in the Union Bar, right, wasn't it? Do, yes, do you remember that? Yes. It was always Scarborough Fair, actually, funny enough, or Mrs. Robinson. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, there was some wonderful music from that era. I like REM. Of course, that was played in the bar the whole time. Somebody, I think, just put money into the bar non-stop, into the jukebox. So,
although, of course, I did interview somebody who actually said that there was a way of controlling what was said, what was played in the jukebox. So they really? Used to have a, there was a button that could be pressed that could actually. So if somebody was sort of going a little bit overboard with something that didn't fit the mood of the moment, they did have a way of apparently superseding, shall we say, what was being put into the machine. Yeah. But that was only admitted a few decades later. So that was unknown to us at the time.
No names mentioned then.
No. But somebody I previously interviewed.
Right, okay. We'll have to look through all the records then.
I find this interesting because I grew up listening to music that was very much like my parents' generation. Mm. Lots of like Buddy Holly, Everly Brothers, late 50s, early 60s stuff. And yet I was also very much a child of the 80s. And I would listen to the charts religiously in those days. And I certainly remember the Bryan Adams, the 16 weeks at number one, because I mention that to my students sometimes and they're like, you know, what planet are you from? Because that really is, you know, distant memory stuff
really?
Now. You know, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, it's like, what? You know, that feels very sort of, you know, very sort of distant and archaic kind of thing. But did music play a big part growing up? By the sounds of it,
yes,
it did.
Yes, hugely. Especially, I think, as my dad actually used to take my sister and me to school. So we'd drive in to Bristol, and the journey was probably just over an hour to school, you know, each way. And he would play. We grew up listening to Roy Orbison, Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley. But yeah, the Big O was the number one with my dad, and I have a particular affection for Roy Orbison, so does my sister. So yes, what we grew up on, really.
Well, I went to see his hologram performance. It was. I think you remember I was telling you about this, and it was in London, and it was a slightly kind of underwhelming experience because I was sitting quite at the way back. By the time I booked the ticket, I was like not row M, but row MM. It was like, you know, they go A to Z, and then they started A, B, B, C, C. So I was right at the back.
Soul-destroying.
And it was, so I saw the hologram, but I was thinking, it doesn't really look like Roy Orbison. But it was a bit uncanny because, and a bit of a gimmick, I suppose, in some respects. But he's one of those artists I would have loved to have seen live. Because You Got It was one of the sort of most formative songs from, because that was obviously
that was
later
in the
90s.
Yeah, oh,
he died
late
in 89.
80s, late 80s, that was. Sorry.
And I think he died literally like a few weeks or days even after the one performance I think he did live of that song. He died within about a week.
Yes, because he was only about 52, wasn't he, I think. I do know that my father regrets to this day not seeing him at the Webbington, which is a hotel and venue very close to us. It's just a few miles away. If that and Roy Orbison played there, I think when I was young. So that's something that he regrets.
Yeah. So for me, I'm glad I went to see the hologram because in a way it was like, well, I never got the chance to see him in person. But I also did come away from that feeling that, you know, I was this close to Roy Orbison, but also I was dealing with something that was obviously, you know, an awful lot of money is being spent, you know, on the illusion of someone.
Manufactured.
But maybe that's no different from any actor who does something on stage. So I don't know. Was the evening diminished because of it? I'm not so sure. But that sort of music. So I went to Lampeter with that sort of heritage. So I was more. I became a Radio 2 person when I was at Lampeter. I've still got all those tapes. I used to record all the sort of stuff that was played in those days. And sadly, virtually all of those presenters from that era have either retired or in some cases have died. So I used to record stuff on the radio, but I'd keep in little bits of the presenter talking before and after, thinking, oh, one day I'll get rid of that. But that's the most precious bit. It's like people who now say that when they watch stuff they recorded off the TV in the 80s or 90s, the adverts are the best bit because that's the bit that really is the point of connection, and that shows how dated the whole thing was because we all remember those adverts from the day. And then, you know, at the time you think, oh, what a distraction, but those adverts, the time filler, the things you do to go and make a cup of tea or something during the program, actually takes on a completely new meaning because that really does, that is the point of identification for a lot of people. It's a cultural reference point. Do you have a lot of those sort of things from radio, from TV, from film, from that era?
Oh, yes. I think we all do, don't we, from when we were growing up, definitely. And, you know, I look back and I was laughing with my children the other day about some of the adverts from when I was little, you know, talking about the Shake and Vac advert. You probably remember that one well. Just some of the hilarious ones, really. Are the Milky Bar Kid, you know, things like that where you think, oh, they don't make them like they used to. Yeah, those were wonderful. But no, I really did love the BBC two presenters. In fact, I remember being about 16, 17, being at sixth form, and I used to listen to Nicky Campbell every night. Right. I absolutely loved his voice. And he first introduced me to Crowded House. So, you know, the band that I completely adore from when I was about 15, 16. And I remember going to university and people, Crowded who? Yeah. I said, oh, I love Crowded House. Yeah. Love them so much.
Yeah. I kind of missed Crowded House in the sense that that was slightly lost on me. The Cranberries were another one from that era.
Yes,
I liked their stuff. But at the time, I think maybe I'd made that transition to Radio 2 when that sort of stuff wasn't being played. And yet now...
Well,
that
he
is,
played it at night time, you see.
But he had a Radio 1. Like 10 till midnight show in those days.
Right. Was it Radio 1 I was listening to?
Yeah.
Not Radio 2?
No, that was because then you had, I'll tell you who was on Radio 2 at the time, the Jamesons.
Ah,
Derek and Ellen Jameson. Yeah, wow. who was moved from Breakfast, and they did this from Glasgow. So I know far more than I should know.
I was wrong.
No, but you were right. But he had that slot at 10 p.m.
Yes.
But he's the sort of figure, Nicky Campbell was never on Radio 2 as a presenter, but he almost got the Jeremy Vine gig, you know, when Jimmy Young left.
Yeah.
But it's easy to make that connection because Radio 2 today has all the sort of presenters. So that's an interesting sort of reference point that we now sort of see the two as very blurred, whereas in those days there was a clear sort of distinction between the two stations. But did radio play a big role for you? Because for me, that was it. Radio was the way, you know, I didn't go to gigs. Mm-hmm. I bought records, but I'd only buy records if I heard them on the radio. So if it wasn't on the radio, then was no way in which I would have known about the existence of a particular act or a particular song.
Yes, I suppose we did just buy records, didn't we? By virtue of the fact that it was, you know, vinyl when we were growing up. Mm. So I remember buying Madonna, you know, and being very excited about that, Belinda Carlisle, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, it was just a transition, wasn't it? And then tapes came out, and it felt as though technology was changing very rapidly around that time, didn't it? Because you had tapes, you had vinyl, and then all of a sudden, probably after we went to university, you know, you've got everything changed, didn't it, in terms of audio equipment?
Yeah, because I didn't even have comp. I mean, obviously CDs were there in the 80s, but I was much more for cassette, because I used to record a lot of stuff as well.
Right.
So for me, cassette was the go-to. If I wanted to buy a song, I mean, obviously record as well, but at Lambeth I didn't have a record player because obviously of the size. So cassette was my sort of... cassette and radio were very much the way I would effectively... Yes. Interact with the world.
I mean, I think when I was at primary school, certainly I had tapes and I would record my own radio show. Yeah. Definitely, you know.
Do you still have them?
No way.
My follow-up question is not we need to listen to them, but I do have a lot of that stuff for myself, and I'm glad I have
from
it.
From primary school, or
there are recordings of me when I was very young, but certainly there is stuff. When I used to edit like Radio 1 road shows, I went to Western Supermare in 1985 to see the Radio 1 road show out on the beach.
Mm.
And I used to record a lot of those programmes and edit them. And the quality is quite poor because I'd record them from the radio and then take out all the music and just have the sort of the talking. And so the quality obviously was much reduced, because you're sort of going from one tape to another tape. And so I do have a lot of that, but I used to do it like voiceovers. But my voice hadn't quite broken at that. So I still have them, but it's sort of like, it sounds like me, but it sounds like a slightly more animated and excited, high-pitched version of my already quite eccentric self.
So you have to play them to your children.
Really. Yeah, that's true. I would barely recognise myself at them on it. So a lot of stuff, I suppose, sort of when I was perhaps around 14, 15, and then my voice probably dropped at some point by 1989, I suppose, that sort of period. Certainly when I... and there is stuff of me reading, like, teletext stuff or something. Because in those days, if we wanted the news, you know, we would... Apart from listening to radio bulletins or the TV news, CFAX was the way to get our information.
That's right. I mean, that's what we had to refer to, wasn't it? But, it does seem like, you know, the olden days, doesn't it, now, talking about it, which is incredible when... In some respects, it seems like yesterday. It's quite crazy.
I had a student, I think maybe yesterday, who's talking about how much they love old films. Now, I think of old films, you're probably thinking like 1940s.
Yes, I think probably up to about 1960s, so probably from before I was born, should we say.
Yeah, a student was talking about an old film like 2007. I saw this really old film the other day. I was thinking, I don't know, I watched that like when I was in Kent, you know. So, but that's interesting because you obviously have heritage plays a big part for you, and obviously you did Victorian studies, but do you have the same sort of interest in the sort of the personal past, the autobiographical past, like the Lampeter past, as you do in the era that you weren't, you know, a part of? I mean, it's that sort of that interest in a culture that is distant by virtue of the fact that you and no one in your immediate family were part of that, and you went to university to study the work of the 19th century. I suppose there will be, there probably already are courses in places where they're studying, you know, 1990s culture or something. And
yes.
We lived that, we were there. So is it the past per se, or particular facets of it that particularly appeal to you?
It's, like I said, I think it's particularly facets of it, because it's that era was intriguing for me. I just love the clothes. I love the way people spoke. I found it very incredibly interesting. And the literature was wonderful. I mean, Wilkie Collins, you've got the first detective story, essentially, and you've got the first thriller, I think it's correct in say, I'm correct in saying, you've got The Woman in White, and then you've got The Moonstone, which is a detective novel, the first detective novel, essentially. I think that's, you know, yeah, that it's more a case of I love that era. And in fact, I was having a conversation with my son, who was saying something that his history teacher at A-level was saying to him. They were talking about the events of 2001 and, you know, very sadly talking about 9/11. And my son was saying, do you know, Mummy, that's now class, Mum, that's classed as history, because that's over 20 years ago. And I didn't realise that. I couldn't quite understand that thinking about 9/11 is now, you know, it's history.
Because when I was obviously we're the same age, but when I was in school, maybe third year in whatever that would be, like year 9 or 10 or something like that, in secondary school, maybe even a bit younger, I remember doing a project on the Second World War, and we were asked to interview our grandparents. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to my grandparents about the WAFs and Dame Vera Lynn, of course, who died actually during lockdown, and she was, you know, well into her hundreds or 103 or something like that. And so at that point, it seemed odd that we were studying something in school where there were people in our family who could remember this, who had a take on history that was, you know, sort of like not necessarily the version that obviously we were studying in the textbook. But I'm wondering if doing this podcast, I'm kind of ensuring that sort of living history is preserved, because I didn't get a chance to interview my grandparents, obviously, not for the purposes of a podcast, maybe at a school project when I was 12 or 13. But that sort of need sometimes to be aware of the things that matter, and that authentic sort of capturing, I find interesting. Because so obviously you engage with Victorian literature, but was there a sort of like a detective element on your part to try and work out like how ordinary people live, or what was the sort of the go-to, what's your favourite novel, I suppose, is what I'm asking at. What is it from that era that really galvanises you?
That's really difficult to say. I mean, as I said, I absolutely adore, you know, Sherlock Holmes. Loved Arthur Conan Doyle's work, but I do particularly like probably Wilkie Collins and the Brontes. And then I go to Dickens as well. I'm reading Edwin Drood at the moment. But yeah, I do really enjoy those works. And it was particularly lovely at Lampeter to meet, you know, Barbara Dennis and Belinda Humphrey, who had those, you know, absolute passion for that era. Wonderful lecturers. Yeah. Quirky, but interesting, really, really interesting.
I'd love to interview those who are still, I mean, William Price is still alive, and I interviewed him for the podcast, and of course he wrote the history of Lampeter.
Right, so that Alan was Samuel has just died, sadly.
Yeah, very sadly. And there is a part of me that feels that they may not be interested in doing it. Same with my school teachers as well, but that sort of need for the older version of myself, when I'm very likely older than those teachers were when they taught me, although at the time they probably seemed really ancient, as my parents, I'm older now than my parents were when I was at university. And at that point they seemed old, because anybody in their, like, when you're 18, somebody in their mid-40s or something like that, of course is going to seem really old, or 50 or whatever they were. So I find that really intriguing.
Yeah, I think that when we were at university, I say it, this is how I felt, that anyone who was about 23 was a mature student. You know, it's ridiculous, really, isn't it? When you think how young they are, yet the difference between 18 and 23, it's not very much, but it does sort of matter when you're when you're young. You can see them as a mature student, because you're just out of school if you've started at university, and, you know, it's a time for growing up, isn't it, really? Yeah.
Because that's why I always find that sort of question interesting about, you know, what was number one of the charts when you were born? Because that is, I think, during lockdown, we were involved in all these discussions about sort of what was number one on your 18th birthday sort of thing? And I think I looked up what was, I don't know if it was the same one in our case, it was a week apart, but it was something, it was, I want to sex you up or something, but it was like, I'm not going to put that down.
I don't think it was that one for me. I can remember looking it up, but I can't remember what it was. My memory isn't great these days.
But isn't that interesting though, that sort of era of, it mattered in the playground at school.
Mm.
The charts. I mean, my children have no idea what the charts are now. They don't even come out on a Sunday. No. But it's so
top of the pops.
So much of that era that was the thing that we all kind of. I mean, not everybody did, but it was kind of the thing that whether you liked the music or you didn't like it, that was the cultural reference point of that era.
Yeah, true. And I think also it was the countdown. It was so exciting, wasn't it? What's number one this week? It was done in such a scintillating way. Yeah. Everybody had to listen or watch Top of the Pops to know what was number one, whereas there isn't that passion about it now, is there?
Yeah. And also, I find that I'm really interested still in the music from that era. In other words, my interest in those charts, which I used to write down, I have them in my office here, I used to write all that down. My interest has never waned. So Pick of the Pops type programmes are completely there, and it takes me back to that era. But anything from now, I feel like I'm channeling my parents, who would always say, my mum would always say, the music's not as good now as it used to be in those days sort of thing. And I feel the same now. I looked at what was number one when each of my children was born, and I forgot it as swiftly as I saw it. None of it registered. It's like watching a film sometimes where it just completely washes over you, and you're watching it but taking none of it in. It really has left no imprint of any kind. Oh. And I'm guessing that that's just the generational thing, and it happens to all generations. Yeah. We are now removed from that sort of zeitgeist.
Yes, I guess so, because we're middle-aged.
Yeah.
Sorry, Chris.
You're the first person to ever confront me with that in a podcast. Yeah, but you are right. Yeah,
there's your answer.
Yeah.
In a nutshell.
Well, I've got to ask you, as we sort of start to wrap up, this whole question about, memories being positive, because obviously this took about nostalgia. I mean, as you look back on your sort of whole life and career, and we didn't actually talk too much about what you're doing now, and I know you edited a newspaper, is that right, was it Hong Kong?
Yes, I was editor of the Federation of Hong Kong Industries. I was their editor.
Yeah.
So I edited the Hong Kong Industrialist.
Yeah.
Which was a monthly publication, bilingual, and I would have to interview industrialists, politicians. Plus, I was responsible for writing speeches for the chairman and the deputies, and they were members of the Legislative Council there, which essentially is like a cabinet, office. So I would write speeches for Henry Tang. He was the chairman of the Federation, and he became actually interim chief executive very briefly after Tung Chee Hwa resigned, I think, from ill health.
Yeah. Do you sort of look back on that era and think, wow, I mean, obviously to be working and living in a completely different culture, but do you have very fond memories of doing that as a profession?
Yeah, I do. I'm quite proud of the fact I did that job because it was very stressful. It was an amazing experience, and I did, at the end of it, I enjoyed it. I did it for about a year and a half, but I was the only Westerner working in the office. And the reason I mention that is because that can be an incredibly lonely experience. If you're doing a high pressure job and you don't really have anyone who speaks the same language, not a native speaker, dare I say it, it's quite hard. They were absolutely lovely people I worked with, but it was tough. Yeah, it was a tough year and a half to work there. But, I had a great experience. I met loads of very interesting people. Henry Tang and the other industrialists who I met, and politicians, they were generally industrious and politicians, were, couldn't have been nicer to me. Plus, I got to go out, interview a lot of people actually at universities. I would interview, so I would choose a cover story each month that was relevant. We would generally talk about Hong Kong, but it could be something slightly different. So sometimes we would talk about, is Israel the next Silicon Valley? So I would interview somebody who was, an industrialist, somebody who was relevant to the trade of the country. And it had to go through my director general to show that that was actually, that was a bona fide story and that would be acceptable to this quasi-governmental organisation that I was working for.
So did you have to do a lot of research for that?
Yes,
because,
a lot.
Because it sounds as though, because that sounds fascinating, but obviously it's quite different from the sort of the more arts and humanities type background that you have.
Yeah.
So it sounds like a great challenge, but did you find that as something that you could have carried on doing, or would you have liked to continue doing journalism in a different sort of sphere?
I could have carried on doing that job. After a year and a half, I was very much au fait with the job and I knew exactly what I was doing. I was very competent at it and I think they thought I was good at the job. But the issue for me was it was quite lonely. So when the man came in who became a good friend of mine, he came in and we had 3 months sort of handover period. And we both said to one another, I think he stayed at the job for about a year. We both said, if we could have worked together, it would have been fantastic. Because to have all that pressure as one person, doing the speeches, you know, for the government, as well as writing the magazine and having to proofread the whole lot yourself, it was an awful lot of work. And it was billed as a 5-day week job, which it wasn't really. I used to work nearly every Saturday, probably, which was common in Hong Kong. My previous job, I worked for the Shipping Gazette briefly for a few months. We worked every Saturday morning. That was general. And I did go for an interview at Radio Television Hong Kong, which you would find interesting. And they wanted to offer me a job. It was a job as a presenter, I think. But around that period, because it was the time of the handover in 97, they were then looking for people who had a visa and they couldn't offer me the visa. Yeah. I had to have the visa. Yeah. So I was interviewed and then told, sorry, had you come for an interview a year ago, we'd have given you the job, but we can't give you the job. That would have been a great job. Great position.
The whole, it might have been.
Yeah,
you know.
But how did you go
there in the first place? Were you already there when you had this job?
No, I went out for a three-week holiday ostensibly because my then boyfriend had gone out there to work and he worked in a sort of very multicultural team. So it was pretty easy to integrate in Hong Kong. And it was an extremely interesting time to go out there, you know, when Hong Kong was handed back to China.
Yeah.
It really was, you know, August 97. July, August that year, we were very concerned, I think, the first few weeks because there were the PRC the PRC soldiers were on the streets. Yeah. People wondered if there would be unrest. Very sadly, there is unrest. You know, there has been the last sort of 10, 15 years, but there wasn't at that time. Everything seemed very peaceful. I guess that the powers that be, shall we say, have gradually changed Hong Kong.
Yeah. And did you ever come? I mean, Chris Patten would have been governor at the time.
He was governor just before. In fact, he was signing his book. I worked. My office overlooked the road down which there was a huge queue of Westerners generally, or all kinds of people actually, who were queuing for the last governor, his book, because he was signing copies of it around the corner. I didn't queue up, but there you go.
No. Although I did read his memoirs not too long, only about a year or two ago, and of course it covers that period. Yeah. But an interesting character for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So your poetry as well is something which is phenomenal, actually, and you always seem to hit, I used the word zeitgeist earlier, but you always sort of during lockdown and during all the various sort of political things going on, you sort of capture a particular moment. And is that something that you've always done? Poetry is clearly something that you're very, very, very capable of, but it seems to be something that always hits the moment. So your inspiration is very much like this is the mood of the day.
Yeah, I suppose I've always written poetry and have always loved it. But during lockdown, for me, it became a real focus. I felt that I was doing something I had to do. It was just something that I wanted to do. And it kept me sane, to be honest with you. It really did. I it was such a difficult time for so many people, for us with children, for people with toddlers, for people who were elderly. And I felt I had to write about the situation, whether I was angry, whether I was, you know, trying to find a humorous point in something that was happening that day or that month, joking or, you know, trying to make sense of the government's, you know, rule of six or whatever it might be. Yeah, it was very important to me to write about it. And I probably would have thought before that I would start writing stories. But for me, poetry was absolutely key. It seemed to be the way to get my point across.
And you have in front of you on your desk the United for Ukraine anthology.
Yes, you kindly bought one of these.
I did.
I brought an extra copy along for
you. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, we obviously this was something that I decided to do last year. So I think it's a whole year ago, incredibly. March 2022 was when it really got off the ground. And essentially I collated and edited a collection of poetry and prose for Ukraine, spoke to many writers and editors that I knew who were very, very supportive. And the result was this book, United for Ukraine, which was published, as you know, by Boudica Press in August last year. Mm. So we did make, I know I became very boring on social media. I had to keep marketing the project because you do have to push for people to buy the book. And essentially, as it's for charity, we wanted to make as much money as we could for Ukraine. So I'm glad that we did achieve that. We did make a few thousand pounds for Ukraine, which was wonderful. And I'm really, really grateful to all the writers who contributed.
And there are lots of Lampeter people. I think a few Kent people as well. Obviously, Linda, right. Linda, yes, who I met thanks to you, actually.
Correct. There's obviously Linda M. James. We're talking about people from Lampeter. We're talking about Becky Jeffcoat. Obviously, Paul Atten Ash, Paul Nash's writing name, pseudonym. And we had Andy Wallace as well, and Danny Webb.
Mm.
So all contributed. I'm extremely grateful to all of them. Yes, it was a real united.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Achievement, I think.
Yeah, no, that was phenomenal and really exciting to see the push that you were making for that and to see, you know, at a time when I think we all felt... straight after lockdown as well, that sense of, and Brexit before that, that sense almost that there are sort of powers, there are things that we are not really able to control.
Mm.
But there is a response. Yeah, it's a humanitarian response.
Exactly. I think that was the point. Mm-hmm. If you feel you can't do anything, I watched the scenes of people escaping their country and I thought, what can I do? And just something in me made me think, well, if we could... I think I wrote the poem... about the sunflower seeds, which was inspired by the woman from Ukraine who stood up to the Russian soldier. That was one of the first poems I wrote. And from that came this idea that we could get people together who would write and produce something that people might like to buy that was vaguely hopeful, that would offer them a little bit of hope in such a terrible time.
Yeah. And do you look back on all that you've done? And, you took some phenomenal things that you probably look back and think, how did I end up in Hong Kong, sort of thing, because that was a long time ago now, and Hong Kong's very different now. But do you sort of look back and do you feel nostalgic about those days? Do you have what is nostalgia to you? Is it sort of bittersweet? It's like the good and the bad. It's like the past that's gone. We can't quite have it back. Do you feel sort of reflective?
Yes.
Do you feel good or bad about the past?
Well, I suppose it's always going to be bittersweet, isn't it, by the nature of it, because if we are looking back to a time in our lives that even if we enjoyed it to some degree, we're going to look back through rose-tinted spectacles. Mm. We really are, because it's a time that we can't have back.
Yeah.
So, I think that's true to say, definitely.
Because I always find that whole... thing about negative experiences, and before we started recording, I was sort of filling you in on what I've done in the last 30 years, but drawing on those things that are challenging in so many ways, but actually you suddenly discover. I mean, I'm drawing an analogy here rather than saying it's sort of comparable territory, but like you did with the poetry for Ukraine, it's like there's something going on, which is awful, and you have a set of skills that you can use to make something okay. And I suppose I have, similar sort of outlets to try and sort of change the way or change the situation I'm in. It may not always be the physical situation I'm in, but at least it means that I can reframe the particular outlook I have. And that makes me feel quite emboldened, actually. Mm. I feel I've got a lot more autonomy now and confidence than I did X number of years ago.
So that's a positive.
That in my case it is, but you don't see it at the time. At the time, you often imagine. I reflect on this analogy of the doors, the door marked future, and somebody standing in front saying, "Thou shalt not cross this." But that the Lampeter pass behind you, and you're thinking, "Oh, those were nice days." But also having a diary from those days means that I can be a bit more realistic about the past, because it's easy to look back and think, "Oh yeah, I did really well, got this great degree, and all that." But at the time, you're stressed as anything, So you can easily whitewash the past in the light of how things worked out. But at the time, you were always worried about the next essay mark, or you're worried about relationship issues, or you're worried about whatever the future has in store, kind of thing.
True.
The next, what will you do when you leave university? And, all sorts of things that kind of matter but don't matter with the passage of time. And I find that way of glossing over things sometimes quite insightful.
True.
What it tells us about ourselves.
I suppose the past always serves the present, doesn't it? So by extension, you're going to find that even if an experience is unpleasant, it can be formative.
Yeah. And do you find that you're in touch with a lot of people from all those different parts of your life? So obviously, Lampeter, I know the answer to that.
Yes.
But all, you know, from your time in China, Scarborough, school, do you have a lot of those sort of network of friends, yes, still available to you?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, I'm in touch with the two oldest friends who I met when I was four, Samantha and Emma. I mean, one of whom still lives in Weston, and one of them lives in America. So we funnily enough, we met up, I think it was a year ago in Weston, which was lovely. So they are my two oldest friends and very dear to me, both of them. But I'm also in touch with old school friends. I have, yes, several old school friends I'm in touch with, as well as obviously university. And then talking about Scarborough, yes, four of us tend to meet up. Great friends, very, very good friends. We're meeting up actually in May to celebrate our 200th birthday. One of us was born in 71, two in 72, and of course I was born in 73.
Yeah.
So we're having a get together. Yeah.
So you've added up all those years, you get to 200.
Yes,
yeah.
It's just over, really.
Yeah.
We're celebrating our 50th.
Yeah, well, so to round it off to the nearest 200, probably.
That's probably the best thing, isn't it?
I've got two more questions for you. One is, what would your younger self think about what you're doing now? What did you want to be, in other words, when you were young?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I always wanted to write, so I would be very pleased that I have, you know, edited and or collated a book and got that out there, and that's hopefully done something for some people and just helped a little bit. That would be something I would have seen myself wanting to do, definitely at younger age. I don't know. I mean, Bennett, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? Who can say, really?
Yeah. It often works both ways, doesn't it? The sort of, you know, the conversation with the younger self. It sounds like something out of The Shawshank Redemption. But, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, there are things that I wish. I kind of feel I'm doing things now that I always wanted to do, or at least I'm on the precipice of doing them. Or like if you're the podcast, I suppose this is the radio show I always wanted to do.
Yes.
But it's interesting that it finds a way of coming out in the end. So almost like even whatever path you follow, if you really have an ambition to do something, if that's your skill set, your talent, whatever you want to call it, you can't shake that. You can't pretend it's not there, or you can, but you probably will feel quite unfulfilled.
Well, you should definitely try to use it, I think, because it's what you're going to feel most passionate about.
Exactly.
And that's the point, isn't it? To enjoy what you're doing and try and enjoy your life.
Yeah. And my very last question is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'd like to say I do both. Probably my family would say I look back because I do love history so much. You know, as well as the Victorian literature I've talked about, I love watching Agatha Christie's, you know, Poirot, Miss Marple. I'm very much, oh, that era was wonderful too. It's rose-tinted spectacles, isn't it? Definitely. But then I look forward to my children, you know, hopefully achieving what they want to with their lives. So, let's hope I'm a little bit of both.
Yeah. Well, very wise words. And so good at last, because I think due to all the various COVID and other issues, you know, we didn't quite get a chance to do this
for a long time.
When we first discussed it. But what a wonderful chance to catch up with you. Thank you, Susan, for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Chris.